Radio City, John Grayson and Rob Ross together once again for episode number 20 of this edition of What We Do Together, where we get together and talk about what's going on, not only here on Popdos, but elsewhere in the globe of popular culture. And Rob, how's everything going with you this week?
Really good, John. How are you doing?
Not bad. I'm glad it's a long 4-day week, and I hope that as many people as possible were able to stretch this one out into Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday with July 4th looming, because there's nothing better, especially in the dog days of summer that we're in right now, to be able to just kick back and relax for a few days.
Well, I am one of the lucky ones who managed to finagle Monday for all of us, so certainly in my office. So I'm very happy about that. You know, I get a chance to just kind of kick back and unwind. And before we took to the air, I was watching the Mets try and come from behind and possibly sweep the Phillies. I don't know if that'll happen. 4-1 wasn't boding well going into the sixth inning, but we'll see what happens when all is said and done. But nevertheless, it is nice to have a longer weekend because it's gotten really unbearably hot.
Yeah, so now you can just stay inside or go to the movies. See, this is the reason in my mind why movie theaters were invented, where it's dark and cold, and who cares that you had to pay $15 to get in there? Now at least you can enjoy their air conditioning.
Except for the fact that you're going to pay $15 to sit in air conditioning and see a piece of shit. But
True.
But the thing is, that has now become, I think, a little bit more the norm in trying to watch a pay-per-view, because Friday night, we managed to watch Trainspotting 2, which I'd sought out in the theaters.
Still haven't seen it, yeah.
Unlike the first Trainspotting, this wasn't everywhere. This did not get wide release.
Nope.
And look, I'll be honest with you. Now I know why.
Really?
You know, it really was, you know, Trainspotting in and of itself is not cute. It's a funny movie. It's definitely an entertaining movie, but at its core, it is a very dark film about a very serious serious main subject being heroin addiction, and then all the other sub-subjects like sociopathy,
yeah,
you know, criminality, pimping, pushing, you name it. But it was done in such a way, it was written in such a way, and delivered in a manner that you actually really cared about these characters. Considering they were all major league fuck-ups of the highest order, you still cared about them.
Right, right.
The big misnomer about doing sequels, more often than not, is you think you can capture lightning in a bottle twice, and in this case, you cannot. Now, I have yet to do the research properly, and I admit I might be wrong, but if I remember correctly, Irvine Welsh was the one who had written the script for the first movie since it came from his book.
Yeah.
This was not written by him, and that was mistake number one. Second of all, there are a lot of drops in linear thought and logic as to the how and why connecting all the dots, why Mark Renton is suddenly back in Edinburgh, and anything worth linking the four characters together. All this was a very, very dark, discomforting, and an unpleasant ride for 2 hours and change.
Yeah.
And at the end, you think to yourself, wow, I care not one whit about these characters anymore. And that's when you stop and you go, you know what? At the end of the day, Trainspotting was of its time. It was at the right moment. It was the right film. And that's it. And this is one of those you can't go home again.
Yeah. And it's funny because our last theater experience was last weekend. And we went out and saw a movie called Dean that is a creation of Dimitri Martin. And I think he's one of the more interesting comedic minds out there right now. And it was an okay movie. It's a very small story by design, but the fact that he and Kevin Kline, the little bit of time, because Kevin Kline plays his father in the movie, which is funny because Dimitri Martin's way older than he looks. But they did some pretty interesting things with what could have been a sort of run-of-the-mill rom-com in a strange way. And yet it turned into some very unexpected things happening. And it got into the kind of strangeness that makes Dimitri Martin's comedy so cool.
See, I have yet to see a comedy that made me laugh
yeah.
the way it was supposed to. in a very long time.
Right. And this one isn't that. It's a much more slow burn, kind of understated sort of story, but it's got those moments where you go, you know what? That was really clever. So, yeah, it definitely, you're not going to lose anything by catching it on DVD.
I mean, I hate to say it, but the last time I laughed out loud in a movie, and this was in places because overall it wasn't a great film and was something of a letdown because of what I expected from it, knowing the ensemble cast, was This Is the End.
Yep.
You know, I'm sorry, you do expect better from the likes of Seth Rogen surrounded by
all of his regulars, yeah.
Right. But that's how many years ago now?
Yeah, 10? Yeah.
At least 5? At the least?
Yeah, it's been a while, but yeah, and they've done better work, and that's the point, is that they could have done something really great with that, and they didn't. So that's always a kind of a letdown as well. But on that side, you know, we were talking about the heat and getting out of the heat. At least mentally, you can get out of the heat this week because free agency started in the NHL. So while we've got some baseball to talk, we've also got a little bit of hockey to talk as well, because New York City's only team, the New York Rangers, they were able to make a pretty decent pickup this week.
All I can say is I joked about it fleetingly the other day. I said it in passing to a friend who happens to be an Islanders fan. And I said to him, watch, the Rangers will always go for the big name, you know, free agent. They'll probably sign Kevin Shattenkirk. No way, no way, no way. And yesterday, the biggest name, the biggest fish, the biggest prize in the sport immediately came off the market and is, in fact, going to be a New York Ranger for 4 years. Now, the thing that I like about this deal is very simple. First of all, he is truly a great player. He makes the difference in games.
Yep.
And he's a solid player. Certainly, he was always one of the biggest nightmares that the Rangers encountered whenever they played the Blues. But the most important thing to me is the fact that he's only 28, which I didn't realize. I actually thought he was older.
Mm-hmm.
He's 28 years old. And I had no idea that he is, in fact, New York born and raised from New Rochelle and grew up a Rangers fan. They had him on NHL Network yesterday, actually, by FaceTime, maybe an hour and a half after the news broke that he had, in fact, signed with the Rangers. And when they asked him, you know, you were given bigger and longer offers. What made you decide to go to the Rangers? And he said, quite pointedly, that it wasn't about the money because he did get greater financial offers with a greater contract, you know, a 7-year deal offered in place. But for him, it was about playing for the team that he dreamt of playing for from the time that he first stepped on the ice as a kid. When do you hear about that anymore, yeah, in all seriousness, that you would turn down money to come to a team simply because that's what you dreamed of being from the time you were a kid? And they asked him, you know, has it hit you yet that you're actually coming home to play for your, quote, dream team? He goes, I don't think it's going to hit me until that first day that we go to practice, I put on the sweater, and I get to meet my teammates and get out on the ice.
Yeah.
That's phenomenal.
It is. Wait, yeah, and that idea of not only having the dream come true, but also, like you said, I mean, having it means enough to the player himself that he's willing to give up money, that he's willing to give up the length on a contract in order to make it happen. That's the coolest thing about it, because that's what, when you and I were 7 and out playing street hockey, that's why we were out there doing that, is because we watched our guys. I was sitting there watching the French Connection up in Buffalo and thinking, boy, can you imagine stepping out onto the same ice that those guys inhabit? And that's why we wanted to do it, you know? And so to have that come back and to find out that a guy who is a pro and who does make that kind of money, that still means something to him, that makes the 7-year-old inside of me really happy.
Well, something else that we also grew up with was our guys always were there. I mean, remember, we grew up in an era when there weren't even names on the jerseys.
Right.
Because the only time these guys ever left the team was by trade.
Yep.
That was it. Or, of course, retirement. You know, free agency in all sports has basically soiled the sanctity of sports, because I'm not putting this on the shoulders of the players themselves. I understand it's business, and the owners are very, very much the reason why professional sports of all stripes have problems. But when a fan base is so behind you and you abandon them, it is very difficult to digest. You know, when we were kids, you know, the shock that I felt when my guys, Park and Rattel, got traded to Boston for Espo and Vadne, that basically ripped the hockey heart right out of me.
Right.
And I was 10, you know, but that was a trade. And plus, Park and Rattel had been there for at least, you know, 7, 8, 9 years at that point anyway. The thing is, it is a throwback. And I'll tell you something, the only time that I can think of anyone who did anything remotely close, it was twice in baseball. Once was Kirby Puckett turning down a huge offer from the Red Sox to take less money just to remain in Minnesota with the Twins. And Tony Gwynn did the same thing to remain with the Padres.
Mm-hmm.
Offers galore, chose to remain for less money just to stay where they had begun and wanted to end their careers.
Yeah.
So, you know, on paper, the Shattenkirk deal is great. First of all, he's a really good fit for the team, especially on defense. But the thing is, to have that kind of emotion coming in is what you need, especially in a team that tends to flounder on being rudderless very frequently. So good job by the Rangers. Very good job indeed. I am very happy. This one, full marks to the Rangers for getting this done.
Yeah, and we stick into the sports category because, as we mentioned, there's some things going on in baseball right now as well. And here we are again. It's the middle of summer, and everybody's looking forward to watching a couple of games, I'm sure, over this long weekend. But there has been a slew of some really nasty injuries in Major League Baseball through the first half of the season, and it seems to have ramped up over these last couple of weeks. And it doesn't seem to discriminate because some big names have been taken out as well. What does baseball do about this?
Well, here's the big rub about it. You know, from the moment the first pitch was thrown this season, we've seen guys dropping like flies.
Yep.
I mean, Adam Eaton, who was the big acquisition by the Nationals, went down season ending.
Yeah.
In I think the first week. You know, guys are already blowing out their arms. Part of the problem is that Major League Baseball's, and I'm using the phrase post-steroid, even though we don't know for sure if it's really true. let's play devil's advocate for a moment. Post-steroid era weight training is geared in the football framework or construct, working on upper body strength.
Yeah.
All the trainers are football-oriented, rather than having them training ball players to be fully rounded as far as their physical conditioning goes, because it's so many leg, hamstring, knee injuries that are taking over, and it's becoming a plague. And I do mean a plague this season. You look around at the DLs of every team, and it is phenomenal how many are all out with leg injuries of one sort or another. And last week, it happened to happen again to the New York Mets, who I am fairly confident that were it not for the injuries that have plagued them from the beginning of the season, they would certainly be in a lot more of a contending shape than one would be led to believe, because a major fraction of their team, their key players, especially the pitchers, are all down with some form of injury, especially leg injuries. And it happened to two of their main players within the last 2 weeks. Second baseman Neil Walker popped a hamstring while running to first base, and then last Friday night, Robert Gsellman, who's one of their up-and-coming pitchers, popped his hamstring while running out a routine ground ball. Now,
yeah.
Think about that. A routine ground ball to first base, and you pop a hammy. The interesting thing and the irritating thing is that Ron Darling, who, of course, is a baseball legend, having pitched for the Mets, winning a World Series in 1986 with the Amazons, is one of the commentators for the Mets broadcasting team on SNY, and he brought up such a very strong, salient point where he said, and I'm going to paraphrase it because I can't remember the exact words, but I want to know what's really going on here in Major League Baseball, because I've never seen anything like this ever. What kind of trainers are coming into Major League Baseball that you have these kinds of injuries happening with such alarming frequency? I don't see anything wrong with Darling's statement. I think he's calling them out for what it is, because every time you're turning around, you're watching a player lay out a very routine play, and suddenly he's now down indefinitely.
Right.
For some reason, the media decided to call Ron Darling to task for this, which I find to be I'm calling bullshit on this because he's absolutely right. And if you're not questioning it, then you're doing a disservice to the sports community. And I'm not talking about the players, the fans, because it is we, the fans, who pay a lot of money to see these teams, to watch their games if we happen to pay pay-per-view costs, if we can't get their games in market, whatever the case may be. What is going on with Major League Baseball? Are they not even remotely aware? Do they not even care enough that players are being hurt severely for the most routine of plays because perhaps they've got the wrong workout regimens in place? That should be overall strength conditioning and not just upper body and building up almost a football player's physique. More often than not, if you're top heavier, the chances of hurting your legs somewhere along the lines are greater.
Right.
If you're not administering the same kind of attentiveness to training and strengthening the legs. I mean, it's just common sense.
Right, but home runs sell tickets.
Well, great pitching does too.
it is something's got to be done, but you're right. I mean, you look at the way that these guys are built now, and it's an upside down triangle, and that's not what a baseball player historically ever looked like. So, yeah, you're carrying around more weight. It's a bad scene.
You know, I think this is going to turn into the "when you and I were kids" show. When you and I were kids and we watched baseball, first of all, pitchers went in on average 7 innings if they didn't pitch a complete game. That's number one. Number two, those guys lugged out injuries. They just played through it all. They had grit. There wasn't any weight training or anything like that. Now you have every form of padding and mollycoddling for baseball players. What is this?
Yeah.
No, is this? Are you basically pandering to little children to keep playing baseball, or is it you're going to have these grown men go out there and just play the goddamn game? You know, I mean, get out there, swing the bat. If you're hit by the pitch anywhere but your head, you get up, you shake it off, you pick the damn bat up, and you swing it again, or you get on first base. Either or.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, precautionary, precautionary, precautionary. That's all you ever hear.
Yeah.
Forget it. It's making the game less and less interesting as we go along.
Yeah, and harder to deal with as a fan, because as soon as you get interested in somebody's run for the playoffs, they lose a top player, and it screws everything up. So now on the subject of pandering to little children, I've been watching the news this week. Oh, good Lord. It is so bad. It's so hideous. And I mean, it's going to do nothing but get worse. And all the media can do at this point about what's going on, this bit between Donald Trump and Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough, I hate them all now, first of all. And second, the fact that the rest of the press, all they can do is sit there and bitch about it is just, again, it's unfathomable. How is it that they can't continue to do their jobs and just sit there whining about, isn't this awful? Yes, it is, and it's your job to do something about it, shithead.
I think you just nailed it right on the head in the short and sweet of it. You know, Donald Trump has obviously shown that no matter what, even if there was, and I'm really using the loosest terms here, so work with me.
Yeah.
Even if there was a human being underneath what we've seen so far, he has zero credibility.
Right.
Because of the antics that never cease. If he had some, dare I say, good ideas, tangible ideas, he has no credibility and will probably not be able to get them pushed across unless the Republicans in control can spite somebody in the process.
Yeah.
Because they do anything, they'll do anything for the president as long as they gain the collective pat on the head, and he won't. Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough are nothing more nor less than a clown show now. You know, I've said it before on this show. She's the know-it-all scold of Morning Joe.
Yep.
When everybody else is making actually reasonable points, she always has to put her little condescending, patronizing 2 cents in, her little finger wagging, her little now-now routine. And it's tedious. Scarborough, now that the cat's out of the bag, that they're actually a couple, is going to play chivalrous.
Yep.
But at the same time, he's gone back and forth with Trump since Trump's been running for president. So this is nothing new. And why I find this such an appalling non-story is that it's not new.
Yeah, exactly.
It's been going on since he first announced it. They lauded it for about 5 minutes. They gave him all the time in the world on that show. And then they started to tear him down.
Yeah.
And I mean tear him down. So at the end of the day, the whole Trump versus Morning Joe battle is absolutely irrelevant. As for the rest of the press, I think you and I know the answer to that. You answered the question yourself by saying, do your job. They're not going to do their job because the press loves to tell you what's wrong, who to blame, and what to be afraid of, while wringing their collective hands saying, see, the president is against the press. In the meantime, the assholes who are his press agents are digging a deeper hole for him.
Right.
Don't know who's worse at this point, whether it's Kellyanne Cuntway, Sean Shithead, or that baggy-eyed galoot, you know, Sarah Huckabee Bernie Sanders. I think I find her to be the most reprehensible of all of them, simply because she's a complete and utter moron. Say what you will about Spicer and Conway. Oh, I hate myself for saying this. They have credentials and a track record. She's just a fucking retard.
Well, I liked her better when she was Neil on The Young Ones. But, you know, after that, it was just over with. See, and the thing is,
that I will never eat lentils.
But the thing is, I mean, with Mika and Joe, when they came out earlier this week and said, we had to put off our vacation to deal with this. No, you didn't. No, you didn't. You could have fucking, nobody would have missed you. Go. Go.
And this wouldn't have become what it became any further.
Right.
It would have it also would have remained in the lap and in the responsibility and the target of jokes on Trump instead of you three now having a pissing match.
Exactly.
That's what this is. It's a public pissing match.
The question was asked by Neil from The Young Ones while they were doing the press conferences this week, because the whole line became, well, you know, the president has to hit back. Whenever somebody attacks him, he has to get to hit back. And the entire press room were in there, and the whole White House press corps sat there and listened to her spin that bullshit as though somebody sitting there on Twitter at 4 o'clock in the morning is fighting. You know, that's what counts as a fight with them. But on top of that, not a single one of them said, why? Why does the president have to hit back? What purpose does it serve?
Because it goes back to what we've said ad infinitum, time and time and time again, ever since the lines were clearly drawn between the press and Trump. And that is, whatever will get any one of those networks or reporters any kind of traction, visibility, any exposure, and worst of all, or most of all, ratings, they're going to keep playing the game and feeding the frenzy.
Yep.
It also, unfortunately, helps when it comes to the possible, and I'm saying the word possible, choosing of the next candidates for either 2018. You know, who's going to be the ones most often in bed with the press?
Right.
You know, who's going to create the good press? Who's going to create the bad press?
And then we're WWF. Right.
And now, of course, was it yesterday that our president, which is why I find him to be the most shameful of all presidents I've ever seen, and that includes George W. Bush, decided he was going to do a jokey kind of video where he body slams a CNN reporter. Oh, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
The president of the United fucking States. That's what makes you, you know, I've said it before, I'll say it again, and I'll say it until he's no longer president. Anyone who doesn't live in the New York area, so anyone who's listening to our show and does not live here, those of us from New York have had to put up with that asshole for the better part of 30, 40 years. We know what the fuck Donald Trump is about. He's a dick, and he's always been a dick. But now the problem is he's the president of the United States, which
yep.
I take very seriously, and I hold that office in very high regard, even when it was George W. Bush, even when it was his father, even when it was Ronald Reagan. You still somehow, in the depths of you, the way we all grew up to understand, is the president of the United States does deserve dare I say, commands a little bit of respect. This man doesn't deserve anything except mockery and scorn, because that is what he asks for. That is what he begs for. That is what he brings to the table. He is the ultimate. He's Andy Kaufman times 100. He is the ultimate bad guy.
Yeah. And just like Andy Kaufman, he likes to fight with women. So, you know, it's about the same level. But I interrupted you. You were about to go off into another point.
Well, apart from the press loving what they can get from the "here's why Donald Trump is a bad guy" routine, you also have celebrities, and I'm taking umbrage with this because it's tiresome now. It really is. I am tired of trotting over the same grounds, listening to the same people over and over again make their comments, whatever side they're on, mostly to the extreme left. Celebrities bring nothing to the table in terms of political parties, and more importantly, winning an election. That lesson has now, I think, been learned more times than it needed to be. And, you know, Johnny Depp's recent comments about shooting the president, I just got through with saying how much I despise Donald Trump, and I do. But you don't make comments about assassinating, killing, hurting, whatever, the president of the United States, because simply put, these are dangerous enough times.
Yep.
That can get you thrown in jail, let alone have you put on national radar in a very, very negative and unfavorable way. Okay, that's number one. Number two, you're a fucking actor. Your job is to entertain me.
Yeah.
Okay? Put on your fucking Keith Richard outfit and go play Jack Sparrow, okay? Or go put on a cop uniform and play Tom Hansen again. I don't give a shit. But don't talk about the president, especially when you don't even live in the country anymore.
Yeah.
You know, enough. And it's not just Johnny Depp. It's every other celebrity that has to weigh in with they think they're golden words of wisdom. You haven't done anything to help get one remotely worthwhile candidate elected. Okay? Those of you who keep speaking out for the likes of Bernie Sanders, now that the investigation into Jane Sanders is finally ramping up in a very focused and serious way, I hope the days of disappointment will be very long, very dark, and very painful for you when you realize, no, this wasn't made up by Hillary Clinton's campaign, because guess what? Hillary Clinton's campaign is long dispersed, and there's nobody running Hillary Clinton's campaign. Hillary Clinton is a private citizen again.
Yeah.
It's not Donald Trump's campaign, because Donald Trump is president thanks to you. Okay, so all I'm saying is enough celebrity so-called endorsements. The Democratic Party, and I'm saying Democratic Party, does not need celebrities. What they need are grassroots campaigns of viable, serious, focused candidates that have an agenda that they can bring to the public, their constituency, and make their arguments valid.
Right. And make them valid across the board. And that's what they've failed to do. And that's why you hear all the hand-wringing now about how many state legislatures are in the hands of Republicans and how many governorships are in the hands of Republicans, because they don't offer real choices for people who live in the red areas of even blue states. So, yeah, I mean, that's why eventually Hillary's firewall was going to fall apart. If it didn't fall apart on her, it was going to fall apart on somebody. So, yeah, as far as the celebrities are concerned, though, you're absolutely right. And the other thing that has become more common is, at least, again, back when we was kids, when celebrities did decide to weigh in on politics, it was usually about an issue. Sometimes it was endorsements of a candidate, but it was usually they picked a pet issue and they went out and advocated for it, and they educated themselves about it, and they knew something about it. Johnny Depp making the comments that he did, what the fuck does that move forward?
Nothing. But here, you just brought up a really good point. When they did it when we were kids, it was done in a very, very subtle manner, too. They weren't up there, they weren't out there stumping for the candidates. They would say their piece, the whys and wherefores of how they felt, if asked any
right.
further about it, and that was it. There was no drum beating. There was no leading, you know. The worst of it was that commie John Lennon. Look what I've got him.
Or, Jane Fonda. Yeah, same deal.
Oh, fuck Hanoi Jane, too. Think I got time for that shit? Right. No way.
But that's the point.
I'm a Democrat, and you know that. And the whole world knows I'm a Democrat, but there are some things that I just don't abide. And when it comes to the way that Vietnam vets were treated, I have real umbrage with that.
Yep.
So, no, Hanoi Jane will never get a pass from me, ever.
Yeah.
And John Lennon, nah, fuck him, too. You know?
Well,
I suppose I'm a McCartney guy anyway, so.
Yeah, right. Well, and on that front, we can move away from this because, yeah, that, I mean, there's just, oh, man, there's so much, and it's just so heavy right now. And it's the 4th of July. This is the time when we should be enjoying a little patriotic fervor or, you know, at least just recognizing the fact that we've been at this now for 250 years almost, and, you know, it's still going pretty well. And, you know, despite all of the challenges that we've got right now, you know, things
on earth.
Right. We're still the standard bearer. And that's the thing is all this bullshit about, oh, you know, we're going to let China take the lead on the world economy, or they're going to take the lead on this or the lead on. We are still the standard bearer on how to run a country without, you know, executing a third of your population. So I'll take that.
Something that you said a couple of shows ago, which is it's about as clear as you could possibly get. And it's like you said, the world's not coming to an end, but it's the press that's doing the hand-wringing for everybody else, because right now people are willingly stupid, and again, underline the word willingly.
Yeah.
Willingly stupid, malleable, and sheep-like, that they'll believe anything that the press says. So they think China's taking over the world economy. Just like that they said that the Russians were going to take over back in the 50s. Well, it hasn't happened, and it's not going to.
Right.
Because this is still the greatest country on earth. And you know what? We may have some very fucked up leaders, but at the core, this is truly a great nation, because there's nowhere else you're going to be able to come to a country with, if you do it the right way, legally, you come to a country with nothing and build a life for yourself. That says it all.
Yeah.
You know, because that's how this country was built. You know, people ask, well, you know, what is the American culture? The American culture is the building of this nation by everybody together, collectively, one way or the other, it doesn't matter. Everybody contributing to what makes the United States of America the United States of America. All you need is a good old-fashioned civics class to try and understand what the fabric of America is about.
Right. Well, I mean, look at it this way. Right now, are people beating on the walls trying to immigrate into China?
Last time I looked, no.
No. So, you know, they're still trying to come in here. There's a reason why. Now, on the subject of the 4th of July, one of the things that's great about it, I mean, it even more so to me than Memorial Day, because I still have a little bit of trouble with Memorial Day becoming what it is, you know, the so-called official beginning of summer or unofficial beginning of summer, and the, you know, National Barbecue Day and all of that, because it's supposed to be a lot more serious than that.
It's like Veterans Day having been born out of Armistice Day, which was a lot more solemn.
Right. And so with the 4th of July, it's a birthday party. It should be treated like a birthday party. So if ever there were a time for a great summer song to come along, this is it. And one did. And it's right now, it's an exclusive on Popdos. And I fell in love with the way this song builds. And I didn't know. And I went back and looked, and there were some previous articles on Popdos about Brothers Prince. I had not seen them, and now I really want to go back and listen to a lot of what these guys have done before, because this song, Sun to Rise, is just fucking awesome.
It's the perfect melding of what we, here it comes, what we grew up with,
yep.
If you think about it, because it's got that kind of 70s soulful, funky feel that these twin brothers, they really are brothers, Ambrose and Austin Prince. This song is a throwback to the summers when we were kids and we were heading to that 4th of July barbecue. It's just right, but it's also, it's not just the groove element to the song, it's the, no pun intended, the warmth of it,
yeah.
The texture of it, the feel of it, the emotion behind it.
But you quickly fade away, I fight, but I can't seem to make you stay. Oh no, I'm just dreaming, babe. You're right beyond my fingertips. It's still so far. And what can I do to make it sit where you are? 'Cause I can't sit, I can't, and I will not let you pass me by this time. No.
Help but think, if their upcoming album is anything like this track, these guys are going on the map.
Well, yeah, and the way that it builds is another thing, because at the beginning of the song, it's very quiet and it almost has that kind of introspective feel. The organ helps because it's the only thing that's playing, and you can feel it that it's coming. And they hold out the anticipation of the rest of the song kicking in for exactly the right amount of time, and when it hits, it just makes you smile. You can't help it.
I'm very happy that I actually got this song.
Yeah.
It was one of those fortuitous moments when it was offered as an exclusive premiere to us. And I said, you know what? Why not? They're new artists. Let's give it a try. And sure enough, I listened to it and I thought, wow, this has got, first of all, there was the connection to my childhood.
Yep.
You know, that was the first thing behind it. But just the groove, the motor, because during the summertime, the last thing you want is fast, loud, and anything less than kind of liquidy and funky with a bit of more of a laid back groove. That's what you want for summertime.
Yes.
That's what summertime is. You know, I very rarely, certainly during my daily commutes, I very rarely listen to rock music in the morning because it just doesn't really get me going in the right frame of mind, especially on a very warm morning. So I listen to a lot of groove-oriented stuff, whether it's acid jazz or you know, funk, or you know, things like 07 and so on and so forth, and Noonday Underground. You know, that's the kind of thing. Or, of course, you know, old 70s
soul
funk. Yeah, soul and funk. And you know, that's where you want to be when you're on a July morning heading to work.
Yep.
You know, and this is the kind of song that you would be playing at volume in the car as you're cruising down the parkway, meeting your friends for a July 4th barbecue.
Exactly. Yeah, it's funny you should say that, because that's exactly what I thought is, you know, this is out in the backyard with a glass of lemonade and the burgers cooking on the grill and that song playing. And I thought it's perfect. I mean, it just fits that mood so well. So, yeah, definitely got to check that one out. The other one, and this came by way of D.W. Dunphy, has a slightly different feel. It's less summer song because the album cover for this one shows a kind of a like a misty seascape. And that's a really good thing because there's a song called Good in It All from a band called The Good Graces, profiled on Pop Dose this week. Nifty tune. Very cool tune.
I like the use of that word because I think it's often been shoved in the background as being corny, but it's just the right word for certain things. That's a great way of putting it. It's a nifty, and it's funny because I kind of look at it as being slightly out of DW's usual wheelhouse.
Yeah.
Don't you think? It's interesting because this act is led by a woman named Kim Ware, who, apart from having, you know, opened up for, having had this band open up for the Indigo Girls a couple of years ago, they've actually been on a bill with, you know, friends of Pop Dose's, friends of ours, The Old Ceremony. So it's that, you know, it's that kind of nice communal feel of the more Americana side of a summer song, if you will.
Looked up.
dig deeper into the context of the song itself, and of course, you know how I am about lyrics, it's basically, and it's a subject that's very near and dear to my heart, it's trying to find the proverbial silver lining in a very dark time, you know. It's trying to find hope when things seem desperate.
Yeah.
I think that's a part of what makes this song really work, because it has emotion, and that emotion is felt by you, the listener. There are times when you'll hear a song, and the performer may have put their heart and soul in it, but you don't get it. You don't feel it. And it's lost. So you're not going to understand the why. This one, I get it, which is why I wanted us to showcase
yeah.
it, too.
Well, and it's funny you should say that, because that's exactly where we're going to go a little bit later on with the In Our Head segment for this week. But we'll get to that in just a few. Before we do, though, there is another one that another one of your colleagues at Pop Does checked out. Justin Vellucci has a profile of a new album from Peter Searcy. Now, for people who don't recognize that name, remind us, where did Peter Searcy come from?
Man, that was when I heard that name pop up. I got to tell you, it made me feel so good. And made me, of course, pine for my youth, because Peter Searcy was in a band called Squirrel Bait out of Kentucky in the earlier mid-80s, around 84, 85, 86. They were kind of looked upon as the Husker Du, I think, of Lexington.
Yep.
Something along those lines, you know? And it's been a while since I've heard anything out of him, you know? I think he might have been... I'm sorry, I just can't remember the name of the band proper. But after Squirrel Bait, who were touted for great things, they were one of those Homestead bands, if you remember the Homestead label of the mid-80s.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, Peter had a band afterwards, and now he's back with something a little bit more, well, taken in context, it's over 30 years since Squirrel Bait. So I think that would be kind of a foolish thing for me to even try and draw comparisons. He's back now with a new album. Justin has given us a very strong review of it. It's kind of that power pop that walks the line of the weirdness of somebody like Charles Thompson, a.k.a. Black Francis, and the raw gut power pop 500 decibel throttle of Bob Mould, which is no surprise being that obviously Husker Du played a big part of the Squirrel Bait blueprint.
I'll always bounce back. Why should this be any different? I'll always bounce back, you see. I'll spend this sign that says cash flow. I think not my time, but they can take my soul. I leave a little pride on the side of the road. I'll spend this sign that says cash flow.
So, you know, there's some things you're influenced by and it never goes away. Okay, you know what I just remembered? Peter Searcy's band after Squirrel Bait was Big Wheel. Not to be confused with Jake Burns' Big Wheel, Jake Burns of Stiff Little Fingers. This was the second band out there called Big Wheel. So, yeah, it was Squirrel Bait and then Big Wheel. But, again, it's a great, heavy, rocky pop that if Bob Mould isn't going to make it, it's nice to know that another veteran like Peter Searcy is doing it.
Yeah.
And I think Justin's review is pretty on the mark.
Good. All right. So definitely want to check that one out as well. And before we leave music, or at least this portion of it entirely, there's something else that we have to go back into the past for, because in 1970, The Who played a concert, and it's funny because every band that's like that, that's been around for as long as they have, and how many are there? There's, you know, you can count them on one hand, but every band that has like a 10-year track record has that one show that they have become identified by. You know, you've got the last, I think it was one of the last public performances in England when Led Zeppelin played at Nebworth Park. And, you know, and everybody has one of those, the Dead at Red Rocks, that sort of thing. And so with The Who, it goes back to England again. And you, there's reason to go back and check out this concert from 1970. What are we talking about?
Okay, this is a brand new DVD called The Who at the Isle of Wight Festival 2014. And as you said, you know, there are those landmark concerts. It's funny because the two that I automatically think of immediately are The Who at the Isle of Wight. Unfortunately, I tend to think of the Stones at Altamont.
Yeah, right. One reason. Yeah.
And Zeppelin at Nebworth in 70, was it 79, right before,
yep.
78, 79, it was right before In Through the Outdoor came out, which was probably the last time also that Page looked even remotely healthy playing with them, because that was when he went into that very, very severe descent into heroin addiction. But The Who played a landmark concert at the Isle of Wight in 1970, and that solidified them, certainly in the eyes of the British public, as being the greatest band in the world, especially the greatest live band in the world, bar none. You can't argue it, and if you try and argue that concept with me anyway, you're going to lose, because I will be here beating the drum, lighting the fire, and standing on my soapbox, preaching fire and brimstone to you from the pulpit. The Who are the greatest live band of all time. No fucking question about it. At that point of them doing that set at the Isle of Wight, it was still while they were performing the entire Tommy album, which they were still riding very high on the charts with.
Yep.
The legend was sealed. Okay, but now, you know, the Isle of Wight, its festival itself, died a death, because like all festivals, especially ones that are aligned with hippies, they kind of just faded into oblivion. Somehow it came back into existence. The Who were asked to come back and perform there again. But what makes this a particularly poignant thing is the fact that this was the first show on British soil after the death of John Entwistle.
Yeah.
So now you have a very different flavor to this. This isn't those four angry young men spewing out the songs that would take them into legend. These are the legends coming home to pay respects to not only their fallen member, but to pay respects to the people who made them legends.
Right.
That's how I look at it.
And to their own past, sure.
You know, and that's how I look at every Who show. And the great thing about this particular show is that this was another one of those shows which I kind of think served the blueprint of what came later on. Because don't forget, this show is from 2004. We're now in 2017. But only in these last 2-3 years, you're getting these incredible, truly greatest hits shows out of The Who. You know, when I saw them, seeing and hearing them do songs that I never dreamt they would ever do, that I would ever see live. You know, like A Quick One While He's Away or The Kids Are All Right. You know, and here they were doing Can't Explain It as Substitute Into Any Way, Anyhow, Anywhere. I mean, my God. You know?
Yeah.
But then they're doing, they did stuff like Naked Eye. I mean, wow, you're really digging into the obscurities, you know?
So how is the production? How's the quality on the DVD?
It's excellent. It really is. It's you know, I don't think I've ever seen a quote, modern Who DVD that wasn't high standard quality. They never look shitty. They really always look good. They always sound good.
Yeah.
That's something you can say about a Who show, will always look and sound good.
Right, but sometimes I've seen a few of them, and again, not for bands anywhere near as weighty as The Who, but I've got a ton of rock DVDs, and the ones, honestly, that have come out over the last 10 years, even if they're good shows, even if they're shows that were well-attended and were in good venues and all of that, there's a certain lack of any kind of cohesive video quality, and it ends up looking like a mid-80s shot on video soap opera, you know, and it just, a lot of them are just hard to look at. So to see somebody get it right is kind of an important deal.
Well, not to bring them into it, but what the hell, it's the Obligatory Weekly Big Star mention, you know. There's that two, I think it was the Daisy, recorded at the Daisy Theater in either 1994 or 2004, the only known full Big Star concert with the reconstituted lineup. There are points of it where it doesn't look great, but it's the only footage anybody has, so you have to take it in context. But it's exactly what you just said, word for word. It looks like it was something that was shot back in the 80s on, you know, on VHS tape.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and unfortunately, too many of them are like that, but it's good to know that this one. So the Who DVD, the Isle of Wight Festival 2004, definitely one to pick up. And before we get into In Our Heads, a couple of things. First of all, there was a big announcement made, and in fact, I think it was made just yesterday by Sony Music Group. Guess who's going to be printing vinyl again?
Sony Japan.
Yeah. Back into this for the first time in 28 years, I think. It's been a long time.
And you want to hear something else? Well, first of all, you know how high vinyl sales are up now?
Yeah.
I mean, the percentage is astronomical. It's like 38%.
Right.
That's the first good news out of the music industry in the longest time. The other big news out of Sony is they've reached a settlement with one James Paul McCartney, you know, the Beatle.
Yeah.
And I think it basically boils down to, because he did this in the American courts, whereas Duran Duran took their case to the British courts and lost, McCartney won. So I think that means, in effect, that starting in 2018, which will be exactly 56 years, and don't ask me where they came up with that number, 56 years, but 56 years after the initial publication of the copywritten songs in question, the rights revert back to him.
Yeah.
So because Love Me Do is copyrighted in 1962, next year will be the 56th anniversary. Hence, Paul McCartney will finally have the rights to the Beatles song.
Yeah, the catalog's coming back home, which is great news. So anything else you want to add before we get into In Our Heads?
You know, between politics, the stupidity of celebrities, and everything else in between, I think I'm ready for a little levity and a little thought provocation by actually having to think about something rather than stupid.
Let's do that thing. So In Our Heads this week, and this was one that for whatever reason just occurred to me a couple of nights ago. I think I may have caught a little bit of it walking through a store and heard a little bit of it over the loudspeakers in the store or something like that. But there was a song that hit. And it was off of Dire Straits' Brothers in Arms, which was obviously, I mean, a landmark album for them. That's the one that had, Money for Nothing was on there. There were a couple of hits off of that record. It was a huge one. But there was a song on there that I think set a mood better than almost anything. And Mark Knopfler's writing is always good for that, for being able to paint pictures and set a mood and set a scene with words. And this song called Your Latest Trick puts you outside of a music venue, outside of a bar, in a bar district late at night after everybody's gone, and you can feel it. You can see the soggy streets, and you can, I mean, everything that comes through when he's talking about that, it just puts you there. And what's great about that song is that he refers at one point to the satin jazz men have put away their horns. And that line right there, while it would seem like almost a throwaway in the middle of telling this story, it defines exactly where you are in the story. And that, to me, is brilliant writing.
Well, that's past last call for alcohol. Fast recall has been here and gone. The landlord, he finally paid us off. The satin jazz men have put away their horns. And we're standing outside of this wonderland, looking so bereaved and so bereft, like a Bowery bomb when he finally understands the bottle's empty and there's nothing left.
And where it took me was to another guy whose writing I have always loved, and who, again, doesn't get anywhere near as much credit as he should for being able to do that same kind of thing, is Stan Ridgway, ex of Wall of Voodoo. And yeah, that was a goofy song, you know, the Mexican radio. It's a great song, but it's not really lyrically deep the way that Ridgway's solo stuff is. And his first solo album was called The Big Heat. And there was a song on that one, and I think it's the last track. It's called Walking Home Alone. And the very last line in that song brings it all back. It's a very lonely kind of song. It's funny because it almost sets the same mood in a different way as Your Latest Trick does.
Turn the key on the mailbox slot. I'm looking for a letter, but bills is all I got. And even the cat she left me with is going out with someone else. So put another quarter in the jukebox, Pete, but don't play that one with the sad trombone. I'll be walking home.
It's still, every time I hear that line hit, and I've heard that song 1,000 times, I think it's all building up to that one line. It's that one moment in the song that just brings it all home. So I figured I'd lay that one on you and say, of all of those kinds of scene-setting, mood-setting lines, just a quick lyric line that most people just kind of pass over while they're listening through to the song, which ones have stood out to you over the years?
There's a song that goes hand-in-hand with a book that has that kind of... When you were talking about the Dire Straits track,
yeah,
and the imagery behind it, I was immediately catapulted to what is still my favorite book of all time, George Orwell's Down and Out in Paris and London, because the visuals of that book live with you.
Yep.
You can see, feel, hear, smell.
Yeah, you're there.
It is actually a sensory experience when you've read this book. You know, you picture yourself in this dank little fetid Parisian garret, or, you know, a shitty, you know, smelly and stuffy London bedsit, and the stench of the streets in Parisian summer, you know, in the back alleys. So that was one of my first thoughts about that. And that immediately led me to a song that I think fits that hand in glove, no pun intended. And that would be the Paris Match, the original version by the Style Concert.
Yeah.
It was on the A Paris EP. That is a song that, after 34 years, still lives with me as an absolute moment of unadulterated beauty mixed with loneliness, and the beauty of loneliness, if there is such a thing. You know, it's funny how Paul, I think the Style Council was such a misstep, but in so many ways for Paul Weller, it is his greatest lyrical achievement, because he wrote words during the course of time with that group that should just be in books as verse.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's one of those kinds of songs that definitely has that kind of emotional pull and feeling for me. Now, funnily enough, there's a Dire Straits song that, you know, it may sound silly and trite and shallow, but the song Skate Away.
Oh, yeah.
From Making Movies, which is probably my overall favorite album by them. You know, and I love the fact that the album's called Making Movies, because that song in and of itself is a cinematic coup de grace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see it, you hear it, and you're in it, because you're those two kids, or you're one of the two kids, who's in love with the girl who just doesn't love you back. And that album came out, and that song came out when I was going through the pains of, I guess, what you would call first love as a teen, you know? I was in love with the girl I couldn't have, because she was, well, apart from the fact that she was the most popular and most beautiful girl in the school, she was also my best friend.
Yeah.
So, of course, that right there is going to lead to emotional trauma. And so I took that song very, very personally, in a good way, because that was during my formative period as a lyricist as well.
Hallelujah. Here she comes. Queen Rollerball. And enchanté. Can I say? Oh. You know, she used to have to wait around. She used to be the lonely one. But now that she can skate around town, she's the only, only one. No fear alone at night, she's sailing through the crowd. Did her ears just fall so tight and the music's playing loud.
So that is one song that obviously our threads definitely connect, but certainly the Paris Match is one because, like I said, it fits. It's the musical counterpiece to Orwell's Down and Out in Paris and London, albeit a few years later, a little bit more modern, but still, not to go on a tangent, but there was a morning when I went into Manhattan very early, like around 9:30, before anything was open. This was during that summer of 83.
Yeah.
And I went with a friend of mine, and it had just stopped raining. So all of a sudden, the sun was out beating down at about 9:30, 10 o'clock, you know, and steam was rising up off the streets from the water that was still there because it was already so hot. And the smell of the city, you know, and the song lyrics fit even right there in Manhattan. You know, it's universal.
Yeah.
So whenever it comes to a lyric that has such a literary or strongly cinematic coupling, you win me every time. There's no losses.
And I'm glad. See, this is why I love handing you this stuff, is because when you hand it back, I get four or five more in my head. But I'll leave you with one, because, again, it goes back to our theme of being, you know, the 4th of July weekend, and the fact that everything is so bright and sunny outside and everybody's having a good time and looking forward to a party. But we've talked a lot in the past about music that doesn't match the lyrics and how great and powerful a tool that can be when you've got happy sounding music with dark lyrics, or vice versa, where you've got, you know, a really dark and brooding kind of music that's got a kind of a humor to it. But there's one song that I think lyrically does that. It sets up that dichotomy perfectly. And I've always been a big fan of David Lowery's writing. And I've been a big fan of Cracker and Camper Van and all of the stuff he's done solo. But there's a song called Big Dipper that's a Cracker song. And it's a very slow, bluesy kind of feel. And it's clear that it's a heartbreak song. David Lowery's at his best writing when he's just had his heart hammered. And this is one of those songs. But it's the thing about it is that it happens in the middle of summer. And so while everybody's out having the party, he's in the depths of this heartbreak and depression.
And hey, June, why'd you have to come? Why'd you have to come around so soon? I wasn't ready for all this nature. The terrible green, green grass and violent bloom of flower dresses and afternoons that make me sleepy.
How great is that? You know, it's just incredible.
It's almost Joycean, actually, if you think about the way it kind of rolls.
Yep.
You know? That kind of contradiction is very near and dear to my heart, because that means you're doing your job the right way. You're evoking one emotion musically and a completely different emotion lyrically. So you're evoking both the mind and the heart.
Right.
And if you're able to do that, and you don't get the trick, you don't get the device or the use of the device immediately, then the song has really, really worked.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, that's certainly given you a few things to listen to if you haven't got them in your catalog yet. And by the way, the rest of Brothers in Arms, also outside of I Want My MTV and all of that, is also full of just some really terrific music. I mean, Why Worry is a great song.
You know, that album sold so well for the rest, you know, for all eternity, Mark Knopfler will be doing The Walk of Life. So.
Exactly right. Yeah, the other number one hit off of that album.
Dire Straits is a criminally underappreciated band, and I'm saying underappreciated band. Brothers in Arms is a good record, but if you really want to get to the heart of the matter and the meat of what that band could do, you go to the first three records. Communique is really overlooked, and that was the last album with the original four-piece lineup, which featured his brother David.
Yeah.
And Making Movies was the last album with original drummer Pip Withers, but they did that album as a three-piece, and I think that's their strongest and most coherent record. You know, it's just a good, good album. And it came out at a time when Dire Straits would not have... It's kind of an interesting thing that they would not have really placed on anybody's radar, were it not for the fact that there are these incredibly strong songs on there.
Yep.
And that's the beauty of it. So you go back, look up the video for Skate Away. And I'm telling you right now, you're going to understand exactly what I was talking about for a start. And people should look up the big heat by Stan Ridgway, because if I'm not mistaken, that album also had
Drive, She Said.
Yes, that was a just Drive, She Said.
The heist song, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. IRS Records. What I remember about that is that one of my closest, dearest friends from high school who I managed to maintain a friendship with past high school. And we actually reconnected, of all things, in the elevator at Pace University when it turned out we were both there. My friend Keith was an avid Wall of Voodoo fan. Actually, he was just a huge IRS Records fan. And he had the Big Heat and played it incessantly, mm-hmm. which is how I knew that album. I mean, part of the reason why we all went to see Bachelor Party was because the soundtrack was on IRS.
Right, right. Well, yeah, and you know, speaking of evoking emotions and painting pictures, Can't Stop the Show is about the best strip club song in a very dark and dire way that I've ever heard. So, yeah, Ridgway's just, he's great at that stuff. But yeah, it's a ton of music now we have tossed at you here in the last couple of minutes. So go listen to some and find some happy stuff too and have a great 4th of July.
Exactly. It's a long weekend. It's a time to be with your friends and your family. Honestly, it doesn't matter what your political stripes are. You know, take the time off from all of that nonsense. Be thankful you're American, period. Enjoy, revel, have fun, eat, drink, be safe.
No doubt
That's
about it.
I ask of anybody, and just enjoy the holiday. So on that note, John, have a great week. We'll reconvene where we can do more damage.
Sounds good to me, my man. Have a great 4th of July.